It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour is Jeffrey Toobin, staff writer for The New Yorker, also senior legal analyst for CNN. Toobin is the author of critically acclaimed bestsellers, among them the book The Nine. Toobin, in that book, delved into the historical, political, and inner workings of the Supreme Court and its justices. The Nine spent more than 4 months on the New York Times bestseller list and was named one of the best books of the year by a number of major publications. The Oath, that's a sequel to The Nine, is an insider's account of the momentous ideological war between the John Roberts Supreme Court and the Obama administration. Tonight, Jeffrey Toobin will be speaking at the Iowa Memorial Union at the University of Iowa from 5 to 6 p.m. as part of the Forkenbrock series on public policy presented by the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. His presentation is titled Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court, and Jeffrey Toobin joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ben.
I wonder if you could give us a quick preview of what you'll be discussing tonight.
Well, I don't think I have to persuade anyone that this is a critical election for the Supreme Court. There has really never been an election in modern Supreme Court history when there's been an outstanding vacancy on the court, which certainly appears likely to persist through into the beginning of next year. So we have four Democrats and four Republicans on the court and a vacancy. And the identity of the person who fills that vacancy, that is the president, you know, could shape the court for a generation. And that's even more true when you look at the age of the remaining justices, who are, in a word, old.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too. You're coming to Iowa, of course, U.S. Senator from Iowa, Charles Grassley, at the center of this current controversy as chair of the Judiciary Committee. Has it surprised you that that the electorate, it seems, doesn't really, let me put it another way, that this issue, the traction that the Democrats thought they would get because the GOP halted the nomination process, that it really hasn't gotten that much traction?
Well, you know, I've spent my professional life covering the Supreme Court, and one of the perennial questions that gets asked is, you know, when are the voters going to start to care about the Supreme Court as a political issue, either in presidential elections or in the Senate races in Iowa? And the short answer seems to be that voters just don't care that much. The voters who do care tend to be the strong partisans, tend to be the people who really want Roe v. Wade overturned or who really want Roe v. Wade upheld. And those people are going to vote for one side or the other anyway. So the people to whom campaigns are directed, swing voters, casual voters, just have not ever gotten engaged particularly on the subject of the Supreme Court. And that certainly seems to be the case in your Senate race and the presidential election at large.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of each party's justification for their position, the GOP saying, let the voters decide who will pick the next nominee, for instance?
Well, this is a debate about political power, not really about right and wrong. It is certainly true that this level of obstruction, you know, denying a president who had nearly an entire year left in his presidency when Justice Scalia died, the chance to nominate and have a vote on someone is completely unprecedented. But it is also true that the Constitution does not set a time limit, and it does set only a political check on the senators. And as we've been discussing, the public doesn't seem inclined to want to punish the Republicans for this level of obstruction. But that doesn't mean, I'm sorry to speak in so many negatives, let me try to put it affirmatively, even though this is an unprecedented level of obstruction by the Republicans, the voters are not interested in punishing it, punishing Grassley, Chuck, your senator, or frankly any other Republican senators on this issue. That's not to say the Republicans are all going to win their races, but it does not seem like the Supreme Court will be the issue that drives them out.
You're coming to Iowa. You'll be speaking tonight about the secret world of the Supreme Court, the title of your presentation. How is this delay, this controversy over the vacant ninth seat, playing out inside the court? Has it changed the court's work?
It's changed the court a lot, and it's really empowered the liberals. I don't think people have fully understood that. The court has gone from five conservatives and four liberals to four and four, with Justice Kennedy potentially and in certain circumstances joining with the liberals. So what? And the important rule to understand about the Supreme Court is that four to four ties result in a decision affirming the lower court, but not a national precedent. So what this means is that the four liberals now have complete veto power over any conservative decision. Now, it is true that some lower court decisions which favored the conservatives stand. That's what happened with the decision overturning President Obama's immigration plan. But other than that, the liberals have won basically all the contested cases. Now, if they get a fifth vote, if Merrick Garland is somehow confirmed or a Hillary Clinton nominee is confirmed, they'll really have a new burst of power. But, you know, the story of last term at the Supreme Court was the story of the empowerment of the liberals after Justice Scalia died.
If Hillary Clinton wins in November, do you think the Senate, let's assume the Senate's still in GOP hands because even if it flips to the Democrats, they wouldn't have taken office yet. Do you think the Senate will, in the GOP hands, will confirm Garland quickly rather than possibly face a different, more liberal nominee from Hillary Clinton?
No. Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, has said over and over again that there will be no lame duck confirmation, that is, between November and January. I take him at his word. I think they are going to fight tooth and nail on this nomination no matter what, no matter who is nominated or when. And the idea that they will give Barack Obama this parting gift of a Supreme Court confirmation just seems preposterous to me in light of what the Republican senators have said and how they've behaved throughout his presidency.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other side of the argument is some would say, well, Hillary Clinton could put forth a nominee who is more liberal than what is deemed to be a fairly moderate voice, at least as far as the Democrats would be concerned.
That's true. That possibility does exist. But I think if you ask Republicans about that policy, they'll say, well, we'll just fight that person and stop that person when the time comes. There's no reason to preemptively surrender to any Democratic nominee. Mm-hmm. So I just don't buy that's a thought process that's going to lead to a lame duck confirmation.
What are the longer-term implications of this move, this delay for the future, for filling future vacancies? Does this set a new precedent that any president in his last year really is not going to get a nominee through?
Well, if the Senate is in the control of the opposing party, I think it very much does set a precedent. One of the things we seem to see with Supreme Court confirmations is sort of a one-way ratchet of more contention, more partisanship. I think the Republicans' decision here cements it. And you know, keep in mind, the Republicans are looking at a much more favorable Senate map in 2018 than they were in 2016. So a delay of if there are multiple vacancies is likely to take place even in a Hillary Clinton presidency if she wins. So, you know, I think we are looking at close to permanent warfare about Supreme Court vacancies.
If you just joined us, my guest this half hour is Jeffrey Toobin. He's speaking tonight in Iowa City at the University of Iowa. The topic he'll be addressing, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. And Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer for The New Yorker, also a senior legal analyst for CNN. Let's talk a little bit about, more specifically, about this election cycle. Many of the party's top leaders have declined to support Donald Trump. That was before the GOP convention. You called it a bizarre situation. Has it in the meantime become any less bizarre to you now that we're, I guess, less than 2 months from election day?
Well, Donald Trump remains a deeply unusual candidate with a background unlike any major party nominee in several generations. So in that respect, it's still bizarre. I do think the election is moving towards a more conventional Democratic versus Republican race where you're looking at more unified parties. I think the support for the third party candidates, as is always the pattern, will melt away as we get closer to election day. And I think we're looking at an electoral map that looks very similar to the one that Barack Obama won in 2012 and the one he won in 2008. If you look at the state races, Iowa may be one of the few that flips. Trump is doing better there in the polls than I think many people expected, at least going in. But by and large, the map seems to stack up very similarly to the one where the Democrats won the last two elections.
What is the future of the Republican Party, depending on whether Donald Trump wins or loses this election?
Well, I think it's really up for grabs. You know, Donald Trump is a, he's unique in so many ways, but he's also unique for a Republican candidate. Certainly the establishment of the party, and I'd certainly include Chuck Grassley in that, doesn't share a lot of that views. You know, he's against trade deals. He's against comprehensive immigration reform. Not that Grassley was for it, but he is against reducing entitlements in any way. These are sort of a more populist line than Republicans have traditionally taken. After this race, especially if Trump loses, I think the Republican Party is going to have to make some really hard decisions about what it stands for.
What are the decisions and which path could
they
go on?
Well, I mean, just take immigration, for one. I mean, you know, after 2012, Rance Priebus, the head of the RNC, did a what they called an autopsy of his loss, and he said the Republican Party cannot go forward without supporting comprehensive immigration reform. You know, we cannot keep alienating this large and growing Hispanic population. I mean, Donald Trump has run the most anti-immigrant campaign in many decades. And, you know, the Republican Party is looking at a Hispanic population that may start to vote like the African-American population, which is something like 90% for Democrats. I think the Republican Party is on a, you know, a demographic death march at the moment. If you look at their popularity with people of color, and I don't particularly know how they address that. I mean, you could see Mitt Romney was not a zealot on immigration issues, but it's the main issue that Donald Trump is running on. You know, I think if you ask 10 people on the street to name one issue that Donald Trump stands for, I think 8 or 9 of them would say he wants to build a wall to Mexico, you know, on the Mexican border. That's something that is deeply alienating to Hispanic voters. So I think it's a very serious problem for the Republican Party.
Jeffrey Toobin, I'd like you to comment on Hillary Clinton's recent health scare. She almost collapsed at an event on Sunday, causing her to cancel some campaign trips. Also, though, this has revived concerns about her campaign or her tendency towards secrecy that has dogged her campaign. Do you think it's unusual that we, the United States, have no formalized, reliable way of testing the medical fitness of candidates for one of the world's most demanding jobs?
I don't think it's surprising. It's bad. We should have some system in place. I mean, just as we have a system in place for presidential debates, which is, you know, it's not part of the government, but it is institutionalized. We should have some sort of similar system for medical examinations, but we don't. And when there is play in the joints, the parties exploit it for partisan advantage. I think, you know, Hillary Clinton very much outfoxed herself by trying to keep her pneumonia a secret. I think if she had simply said on Friday, I have pneumonia, I'm sick, I'm going to take the weekend off, you know, there would have been some grumbling and criticism of her, but it certainly would have been a better outcome than what has followed. I do think that, you know, 2 months from now on Election Day, not a lot of people are going to be thinking about this, assuming that she recovers promptly and starts campaigning very soon and looks like the vigorous person she has always been. I actually think that this issue will pretty much fade away.
I'd like to ask you a couple of questions about things away in your life, away from politics. The FX series, The People versus O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story, based on your book, Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson. The series has gone on to receive 22 Emmy nominations, and I understand from Iowa City, your event in Iowa City, you'll be heading to the Emmy Awards this weekend. Good luck on that, first of all.
I thought they told me that the Emmys were going to be in Iowa City. Isn't that where they're usually given out?
Well, we've got some preparing to do then.
Because that's you know where all the stars always want to go. Now that I think about it, actually the Emmys are in London.
Okay. Good luck. But I wanted to ask you, Jeffrey, why does the O.J. Simpson story continue to captivate the Americans?
Well, to quote myself, the O.J. Simpson case combines everything that obsesses the American people. It's got sex, race, violence, Hollywood, sports, and the only eyewitness was a dog. So, you know, when you take that incredibly toxic but compelling combination, combine it with a televised trial, it was sort of inevitable that the country would be interested. And it turned out to have, you know, a cast of characters and plot twists that dwarfed fiction. So there you go.
Your latest book just out, American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst. What made you choose Patty Hearst as a writing subject?
Well, I got interested in the 70s as a subject because I don't think people remember or recognize just how crazy the 70s were, how violent. 1,000 political bombings a year in the early and mid-70s. I mean, wrap your head around that idea. And the case had not been written about by a journalist in many decades, and I saw a great opportunity there. And fortunately, I think the marketplace has responded in a way that people wanted to know, because there is a mystery at the heart of this case, which is, did Patty Hearst become a terrorist like her captors, or was she coerced?
And so it has something to say about our age of terrorism and the age of Al-Qaeda terrorism?
Well, I think it does in one respect, in that one of the things we have learned is it's very hard to predict who will become a terrorist. you know, we like to think there is a profile. We like to think there is a something we can do to interrupt what becomes, what makes someone become a terrorist. And I think the Hearst story, not just because of Patty's story, but if you look at the other members of the Symbionese Liberation Army, most of whom were just middle-class kids who were, you know, very who came from stable backgrounds, how did they become terrorists? It's just very difficult to predict.
Very quickly, before we have to go, you're speaking tonight in Iowa. I'll have to ask you to comment on the Iowa caucuses. Your thoughts on Iowa's role as the first in the nation test of the primary candidates?
Well, I mean, not to alienate my host, I think it's appalling. I think it's appalling that Iowa gets to go first all the time. I think it's appalling that it's a caucus and not an election. I love the people of Iowa and have visited happily many times, but I think the system is not one that a real democracy should participate.
Right, and we are the site of the Emmy Awards, so why do we need the caucuses?
Exactly. Live it up, pal.
Jeffrey Toobing, thank you very much. We look forward to welcoming you here in Iowa. Jeffrey Toobing, staff writer for The New Yorker, senior legal analyst for CNN. Jeffrey Toobing will be speaking tonight at in Iowa City at the University of Iowa as part of the Forkenbrock series on public policy presented by the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. The title of his presentation, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. No tickets required. 5 o'clock at the Memorial Union on the University of Iowa campus. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.